Good afternoon. It is 12:02, and it's Friday. You know what that means. Usually, State Senator Chip Bradley's with us. He's on vacation for the.
Thank you for having me again, Eric. And you know, I talked to the senator the other day, and he's having a great time with his family out in Colorado.
Oh, good. And how's he doing? Okay.
He's doing wonderful. He's been really decompressing and getting ready to serve Granite Staters in the 3rd Senate District. You know, all the way up to Conway, down to Wolfboro, or most of Carroll County, plus Middleton and Milton. Yeah, Middleton and Milton, Carroll County, and Waterville Valley. That's his 3rd district. And, you know, he's going to be probably back by around a little bit after Labor Day. And when he comes back for Labor Day, there's going to be a number of pieces of legislation that he'll be working with the governor to fix and improve and make sure that they can get through Senate committees. And on the House side, we'll be able to concur with those and get a number of good bills to the governor's desk.
He just signed a couple, didn't he?
He did just sign a couple the other day. Trying to get the noise.
Is that not loud enough?
No, it's a little too loud.
Oh, a little too loud. Here, how about that? Is that better? Is that better?
Yeah, that's a lot better. Thank you, Eric. Okay.
No problem.
He signed a bill that had to do municipal net metering, which is going to allow counties and municipalities now to partake in the net metering regulatory measures that we have in this state.
Not to interrupt you, but to be clear, this has nothing to do with people and their own net metering.
No, people already can net meter in this state, and that's actually Senator Bradley led the charge on that. Governor Chris Sununu vetoed a net metering bill, and Senator Bradley was he stood up for Granite Staters, and you know, in a place where they might have disagreed, Senator Bradley made the better argument within the House and the Senate, and they actually overrode the governor's veto a few years back on that one. But this is gonna expand net metering to municipalities, to counties. So then, when governments, you know, municipal and county governments want to create green energy projects, specifically probably more regarding wind and solar, it's gonna make it so then that the cash that they get back from the utility companies is going to be more. So it's going to further incentivize that. It's going to further save taxpayers money. And it's going to make it so then, you know, we're going to have a great balance that we have in this state right now, which is being cognizant of energy cost for consumers, making great future investments that aren't too burdening on taxpayers, and also caring for the environment, right? We're balancing those three kinds of things in this big picture. And the governor was very happy yesterday I believe it was at the dairy transfer station where they have a solar array to help them, you know, keep their energy costs down in their community to say, look, you know, you guys made a smart investment. You guys are making a cognizant decision that's going to help the environment. And it's about time that the state help you guys, you know, better reward your taxpayers for approving those kind of spending projects and helping the community save money and save energy.
So the Reader's Digest version is it's an incentive to local governments or county governments to do their own clean energy projects.
I think
because you could
sort that would be a very
sell the unused power back to the utility.
It makes it, you can already sell the unused power back to the utility, but you have to sell it at the wholesale. Well, you did until the governor just signed the legislation, right? So there was a higher amount that, you know, people who are ratepayers, right, individual ratepayers, they were already under net metering, so they got more money back from the utility companies for the energy that they produced and put back into the grid. But counties and municipalities and the state government was still putting it back at the wholesale rate. And so Republican and Democratic lawmakers, and I sponsored a bill on the House side of this. My bill didn't get passed, sadly. It was quite literally the same exact language. So they just went with the Senate bill that Senator Bradley prime sponsored.
So, is there a reason for that? I mean,
yeah, because Senator Bradley prime sponsored it. that's probably why. I mean, they know him a little bit better than it was myself and Representative Lang, Tim Lang, who's from Sanborntown. Over on the other side of the lake, Sanborntown, I believe Tilton is his district. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they were the two. Usually you'll propose of a bill that's like important like that, that's going to really help, you know, because, well, first let's finish up our last thought. Then I'll explain why I think they went with, you know, one bill as compared to the other one, even though they're identical language and even though any amendments that were needed were also identical and both introduced in either committee. But so essentially what this is going to do is it's going to just incentivize governments across the state of New Hampshire, municipal, county, and the state government itself. It's going to incentivize and it's going to make it more tantalizing to put up solar or wind projects. And that's a good thing because it's going to make it so then at a faster rate, solar is going to cost less than fossil fuels, right? When you have net metering, it's a lot easier for someone to make that investment and for them to make their money back on that investment faster and to be able to make profit and save stuff, you know, save that taxpayer money that you've made in, you know, profit aside for reinvesting to get new solar panels and better technology in the future, right? You'll put that into your capital reserve. So for example, if it was like, let's say the town of Wolfboro decided to put a solar array at our transfer station, which in my opinion would be a great idea, the cost for that, you know, would be a fairly substantial cost up front. But the money that we would save, right, with this bill has now become, you know, it's come a shorter time to save the money over, you know, the 10-year period. That's going to make our money back on that project. And then plus the 10 years after that will all be money, you know, because we'll have saved over the first 10 years estimated about of the cost of the solar panels mm-hmm. with this new net metering bill. And solar panels typically last 20 to 25 years. So the last 15 years, any money that, you know, we were previously spending, maybe let's say it was a bond, right, you could put aside into a capital reserve. Right into our capital reserve, and then know you're going to have the money there for when you need to get new solar panels. It becomes self-sustaining cost, right? Mm-hmm. So we just have to pay the upfront once, and then after we pay the upfront once, it should cover itself. And net metering makes that more possible, and it just gives municipalities another option for how they can save, you know, how they can make investments and save taxpayers money. Now, as to why I think Senator Bradley's version of the bill won over mine, even though they were identical language, it's pretty common practice where you introduce a bill in the House and the Senate that are identical in case one gets scuttled for some reason, right? Okay. Something strange happens. There's a misunderstanding. There's an internal party debate and a divide over how an amendment should look. That if one bill fails one year, you have the other bill retained in the other committee and ready to work on the next year or even later in the same session, right? So my bill, I think, and I didn't know it when I co-signed onto it because I thought my bill was a leading proposal, House Bill, I believe, 106. Mine was, I think, the backup bill, and I didn't realize it. So, but I worked just as hard on it, and at the end of the day, what matters is that we got the result that we wanted, which is net metering for municipalities and counties, and to give, you know, local taxpayers and local officials, you know, another option for how they can make investments to save energy costs for taxpayers and to prepare for this 21st century and what's going to be a greener economy going forward.
Do you think Wolfboro could stand to use a clean energy project?
Yeah, I think especially with this bill, it becomes very feasible. And I think, like I said, you know, based on the costs and with net metering, if we made an upfront investment over 10 years, it would pay itself off, but that investment, that solar array, would probably last 20 to 25 years. Mm-hmm. So if we made that one upfront investment, I think it would be, I think a solar project would be self-sustaining. And I think it would be very beneficial to the taxpayers because it would decrease the total cost of energy that they're already paying for, right? Because the taxpayers have to cover the energy for every public building mm-hmm. in the town, you know, cost of heat, cost of lights, cost of whatever have you, electricity, etc. But if you had solar, right, and you make that one investment one time, you know, up front, right, and obviously it wouldn't cover the entire town's energy, but, you know, if you did it, put it on a number of buildings and got some federal grants for it and some state grants, I mean, you could do it getting grant money to make the upfront cost already really low, right? Mm-hmm. Get some appropriation from the taxpayers, get their approval via the ballot. And then over a 10-year period, I mean, you're going to be able to, and probably with grants, it'll be even less. You can maybe pay off the entire project over 5 years. Know that you don't have to get any new solar panels for 25 and save money aside each year, a small sum, right? A small sum aside each year. So then you can rebuild those and get new solar panels in the future once the technology improves and once the current, you know, once the, what would be current solar panels got old and less effective and less efficient. And the other thing too is my guess would also be 25 years from now, there'd be many more state and federal grants to utilize. So there would be a chance that you get to the point where you need to buy more solar panels to say, actually, looks like we saved too much money aside, so now we have this extra money to buy down the tax rate and to spend on other projects too. So I think actually a lot of people look at solar because, you know, it's gotten a bad rap because 20 years ago when it first came out, or even 10 years ago, right, you would buy solar panels, and then by the time you had to get new ones 25 years later, you would maybe break even.
Right.
Now we're getting to the point where that's no longer the case, where actually you're not only, you know, you'd break even, and then you would have to go and get, you know, put up that new money up front, right? But now we're kind of getting to the point where you can save enough money over, you know, the 25-year period, and then even save enough money over the second half of that 25-year period for it to kind of pay for itself, okay, if you will.
Now, instantly, the talk turned to solar. What about wind?
Well, wind is a huge priority that the governor is making in the future, right? The governor has talked about how he wants to see offshore wind, similar to projects that they're considering right now in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, a number of other states. Because offshore
in New Hampshire, in Plymouth.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of windmills in Plymouth, but I'm talking about offshore wind, which has more consistent wind speeds.
Okay.
You can make larger turbines, and you can put them so far off the coast that people can't really see them as much, okay, right? Now, the one concern for that on the flip side is how would it affect fishing or the lobster industry? And, you know, could it mess up with migration patterns of fish? Could it mess up with the trolling that some of our local fishermen do off of our coast? But I think the state would be cognizant of that, and our New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services would be cognizant and, you know, recognize, right, what's realistic and what's going to, you know, not hurt our fishing industry, and also how to maximize that kind of offshore wind power and really get a good clean source of energy and increase the amount of energy within our grid to decrease the cost of energy for everyone in the Granite State.
Well, that makes sense. The biggest problem with wind that I see is it's damn ugly. But
I think that's part of the point of why they want offshore, because I mean, if it's so darn offshore, right? And you can't see it,
right,
then you don't notice how darn ugly it is. That is a complaint. As much as I try to make it look sleek, professional, modern, no one likes a windmill in their backyard. People love the idea of wind power. They love the idea of, you know, having, you know, some windmill where they can't see it powering their house. But if you tell them, well, yeah, but the windmills that are going to have to power your house, you might have to see them on a daily basis, a lot of people will be like, I'm not a huge fan. The other thing, too, is the noise from them. That was a concern in the past. The noise has really been cut down. There is also the other part, especially if on land windmills, which has to do with how they might kill birds and hurt migratory patterns of birds. But that really is dependent upon how large your wind farm is. So if you have like a massive wind farm, like some of the ones they have out west, that could be a larger concern. I'm unsure if even the one and I believe it's in Plymouth, but it also part of it might be in Hill, New Hampshire too. But I'm unsure how large that wind farm is and how much it actually might affect birds' migratory patterns. But I mean, we have a great New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, and I think they would be more than happy to probably work with our new energy department that we just established in our recently passed budget that the governor signed back in July, first week of July, and for them to coordinate and really, you know, plan a strong energy future for New Hampshire, where we're able to utilize multiple types and diversify our energy portfolio, but really start to make these smart investments in green energy that will, you know, be an upfront cost today, but over the long run, save taxpayers and save Granite Staters money and decrease energy costs.
Okay. Not to bring partisan politics into it, but sometimes you have to. The Green New Deal, universally condemned by Republicans. I don't have an opinion on it. I'm not going to espouse one. But why is it that, for some reason, fossil fuels seem to be more supported by Republicans? Or is it the bill itself that's the problem?
Well, I think it's quite... There's a number of things. There's a number of questions you've asked in one question. But let's first address the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is a... I wouldn't even call it liberal. It's a socialist. It's a socialist wish list.
It's pretty far left, yes.
It is very far left. It would make FDR blush if he looked at it. It doesn't address only... Let me put it this way. If the Green New Deal only addressed how to expand block grants and funding for green energy companies, then, you know, I think there'd be a lot less pushback. There would still be pushback from a lot of senators and congressmen from southern states who represent the fossil fuel industry, because that's important to their district. That's important to their constituents, right? And you might see less of a partisan divide. If this was actually a bill that they say that it's intended to do, which is to make investments into a greener energy grid, to update our energy grid as it is, because, you know, we know in a number of our infrastructure proposal that Washington, D.C. just passed, a bipartisan one, $1.9 trillion, that appropriates $550 billion new dollars, right? Of the $1.9 trillion, only $550 billion of it is going to be new tax dollars. That actually addresses some of our issues with our energy grid. It doesn't make investments and expand grants for green energy projects. But if the Green New Deal, and it wouldn't be a new deal if it only addressed, you know, expanding energy projects, increasing grants, you know, getting block grants to states, helping municipalities establish new green programs and everything, and et cetera, right? We're talking about a bill that got to the point where it was starting to regulate the amount of methane that was produced by farms, right? Essentially, regulating cow burps.
Like farmers don't have anything else to deal with.
Yeah, like they don't already have to deal with a whole host of other regulations. And I mean, there was a whole bunch of other stuff in there, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but that was just unrelated to the goal of getting more grant money to states and to municipalities and to private industry to incentivize them to create more green energy in this country and to save taxpayers and to save ratepayers money over the long run. It was just absurd. I mean, in my personal opinion, it shouldn't even be called the Green New Deal, because most of it is just a new deal. It should just be the New Deal, right? And it's not even like the New Deal where you're spending on essential, you know, social services. You're just expanding regulation and, you know, introducing all these plans hidden within. I mean, this is a big thing that we've seen happen in Washington, D.C. over and over and over again, where these bills, they start and, you know, someone says, I have an idea, we should, you know, make major investments into green energy. And everyone's kind of looking and they're a little skeptical. And they're like, okay, this could be interesting. Maybe we could actually, you know, find a bipartisan solution for this and, you know, get some block grants to states and, you know, incentivize municipalities and counties to, you know, to make investments in a greener infrastructure. And then you have someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who introduces this Green New Deal, and it's just an absolutely non-starter with how many unrelated regulations and social programs that she's trying to stuff into this bill. And I shouldn't single out the congresswoman either from New York, because Republicans do it from time to time too, right? We've introduced bills, as you know, as a party, that do the same exact thing, and it's part of the reason why Washington's so broken. But
let's talk a little bit about what a block grant is. You've used the term quite a bit, and I got to admit, I'm not exactly sure. What comes to my head is the federal government says to New Hampshire or any other state, here is a block of money. And then the state is responsible for whacking it up into who gets what, or does it filter further down?
You are exactly right.
Oh, wow.
And it can filter further down, too.
But, honey, did you hear that? I was right.
But, yeah, I mean, it was something that actually Ronald Reagan, you know, block grants have existed for, I don't even know for how long, but Ronald Reagan was one who really championed them, where you set some very basic parameters and guidelines for the block grant, but at the end of the day, you let the state decide, you know, make the majority of the decisions and decide, you know, how they're going to implement it on a local, a county, and a statewide level, if they're going to maybe only do it on a statewide level. But it block grants give states a lot of leeway to be responsive to their constituents and to their needs, right? They're a little bit better than maybe, you know, what might be a very precise and specific grant. So in my personal opinion, I wouldn't see a problem if the federal government and if Democrats decided we want block grants that, you know, specifically, you know, help help make better, you know, help improve our energy industry and help improve our energy infrastructure by investing in solar and wind. If it was, you know, if it wasn't too stringent and if it was legitimate and if they had some actual plans and if states could have some time to formulate some plans before they got the block grant money so they could efficiently spend that money to save ratepayers and taxpayers money, I think that would be a good idea. But that's not, they haven't done that once. They haven't done that once. And until the day that they do that, then I don't think they can get much credit for even being the party of green energy, right? Because when you have Republicans in New Hampshire right now that are expanding net metering, that are ensuring that investments are being made, that are establishing a Department of Energy, that have done more to expand green energy in this state than Democrats. I think that speaks volumes. I think that's just a difference. And I think that's what makes Governor Sununu such a great governor also, is, you know, looking at an issue objectively like energy, recognizing that we need to update our energy infrastructure and, you know, how we, what kind of energy sources we're using, and just being a manager and really managing and helping the state and helping through the budget process make those investments. And I think that's a huge difference, that, you know, someone, you have to be a good manager to get things done. And Governor Chris Sununu has proven time and time again that he's been able to manage us, whether it's through the COVID crisis, whether it's through investments in green energy, whether it's in, you know, helping with all this ARPA cash right now, right? And being a great resource to municipalities, to counties, and, you know, as a state, how we're going to spend that money too and everything. The governor has really proven time and time again to be a great leader.
Right. I find it interesting that we talk about that the governor has really done an excellent job, but that's because he's had to be bipartisan. I don't think you can't get anything done without being bipartisan. I know you've talked about that many times. Then why is it, if everybody knows that, much like you don't push kids on the playground, why is it we still have on both sides this, you know, people running for the edges? I'm not really sure. I mean, or are they just the ones that are loudest and the ones you hear?
I think it's a little bit of both. And I mean, let's go back to what we were talking about, why the Republican Party is, you know, so strongly aligned with oil and gas. And, you know, I don't have a problem with oil and gas. I prefer green energy, right? I think green energy is the future. I think it's a better investment for taxpayers. And we do actually subsidize oil and gas. And I think that is somewhat of an issue that makes it
do
so.
We?
We do, actually. Oil and gas is a very, very subsidized industry. A lot of people, and coal.
Despite $3 a gallon.
Despite $3 a gallon, but, and that's part of the reason why it stays subsidized, because if, you know, we got rid of those subsidies, the price of gas at the pump would probably increase a little bit.
Now, for the fossil fuel part of it, what about ethanol?
Well, ethanol's from corn.
Right, it can be. I mean, you could make it from all kinds of things, but corn specifically.
You know, I don't know enough about the federal gas regulations, because there's specific, I believe that there's a specific amount of ethanol that you have to put in your gas or something.
Right.
So then
it's 10% if you read the sticker on the pump.
And I think it has to do with the fact that they use some of the corn that they subsidize farmers to grow, because our livestock and a lot of our entire food industry is dependent on that corn. And then also farmers will produce so a little bit too much. And so when the federal government buys it to make sure they keep the prices at a proper rate, you know, or at a proper price point to make it so the farmers don't completely, you know, go bankrupt after one crop season or something, they'll end up making some of it into ethanol. There's a whole complexity to how the Department of Energy federally and the Department of Agriculture have worked out, you know, ethanol and gas and how that helps corn farmers and how that helps oil producers. But my broader point, though, is the fact that sometimes this stuff can be very regional. So we might live in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire is a lot less of a, you know, a very partisan state than, let's say, you know, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
right? And so what's popular in Alabama might not be popular in New Hampshire, even amongst Republicans. So that's part of it too, right? And some of those louder members of Congress are from very specific regions. I mean, you look in the Democratic Party, they tend to be from California,
right.
New York, you know, larger liberal cities, urban areas, and
right.
The Republicans tend to be from the South. They tend to be from southern rural districts. So I think that's one of the reasons is that those members that are a little bit louder are from regions and are from congressional districts where they have constituents that actually like that they're that loud and like that they're that partisan. I think the other thing, too, is that when you run for re-election, you have to go through two elections every single cycle, right? Every 2 years, I, as a state representative and someone in Congress who's a congressman or congresswoman, has to go through two elections. They have to go through a primary, and they have to go through a general election.
Mm-hmm.
You have to win the first one, the primary, and it has to be won amongst your party to get to the general election.
Right.
Those people who vote in the primary, they tend to be a little bit more partisan. So to ensure that you don't have to get primaried, to ensure that someone else within your party says, you know, I don't think you've been liberal or conservative enough, there's a certain expectation amongst people and peers within your party that you're going to ensure that you be that voice for the party, also while also being that voice for overall constituents, which can be quite difficult. It can be quite difficult because sometimes, you know, one specific party and its stance on something nationally does not align at all with an entire district, right? Because of that regional divide that I just, you know, kind of, and an example would be with oil and gas. If I was a congressman, let's say hypothetically I was a congressman from New Hampshire's first congressional district, it would be in, I believe, in my constituents' interest of the entire district to make smarter investments and better investments in green energy for the future and to divert some of those subsidies from oil and gas, right? Because that's the government subsidizing an industry. I think the government should subsidize industries that are going to be more sustainable. They're going to, you know, save taxpayers money in the long run. Subsidizing oil and gas doesn't save taxpayers money, right? It saves the overhead costs for large oil and gas companies down south. I think investing in solar and wind and diverting that kind of money over would save Granite Staters, you know, it would save them a lot of money on how much they pay on electricity overall. So, however, if I was a, you know, a Republican congressman, there'd be a lot of people within my party upset. And there might even be a number of people in New Hampshire that would say, you know, because of the misnomer that green energy inherently is going to be more expensive, that would maybe say, well, I don't think you're really representing the Republican Party because we're supposed to be the party of fossil fuels. And it's like, well, you know, not necessarily. I don't think the Republican Party has to be that kind of party is the first thing, as I would say to them. But the second thing is, well, I don't think the investments that we're currently making in fossil fuels, these subsidies, are actually going to save you money in the long run. I actually find it as if your taxpayer money is being kind of thrown into fossil fuels for no greater benefit to yourself, where if it was that money was diverted into clean energy projects and solar and wind, that you would see savings over, you know, a decade and two decades.
Right. While we're on that subject, we talked about districts. How do they draw district lines? There's been some, what's the term, gerrymandering, I believe. Not necessarily in New Hampshire, because I don't really know where the lines are drawn, but throughout the country, there are a lot of gerrymandered districts.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that allowed? I mean, it's pretty obvious it's done for partisan reasons.
Each state is allowed to decide how their districts are drawn.
Okay, so it's a local control thing.
The states decide how they draw their districts. The majority of states draw their districts similar to how New Hampshire does it, where you have a redistricting committee and a group of politicians and whoever holds a majority in the House, right? They have the majority on that redistricting committee, and they sit down and they draw the districts based on what the parameters are. And there's different, depending on your state, there's statutory parameters and constitutional parameters. New Hampshire has both. We have statutory and constitutional. Some states might have only statutory. I don't know if there's any states that have only constitutional, but I would assume most states have statutory and constitutional requirements, and they draw the lines based on the laws that we already have written on the books, and they draw those lines for state house, state senate, executive council, and then Congress, right? And they draw those lines. Some states have a lot looser statutory rules, so they really push the envelope for the benefit of their party, and it happens. Both parties do it.
Oh, yeah, I'm not singling one out.
And then some states, though, have a statutory law where they have an independent redistricting committee, right? Mm-hmm. And the legislature decides that instead of having their own redistricting committee that then gives a proposal to the overall House and Senate, that they'll have a group of people who are approved and appointed by a redistricting committee to make districts that are supposed to be, you know, made by nonpartisan third party that then presents a map to the House and the Senate in their state. And then the House and the Senate typically, you know, and I think one state that does this is California, they'll typically approve it, and it's supposed to be, you know, the fairest districts and the most competitive districts that can be drawn on the aggregate for the entire state.
Okay. When you talked earlier about statutory and constitutional requirements, do you know what those some of those are?
I do not know what they are in New Hampshire. I do know one, right? To my understanding, and I could be mistaken, but I'm 99% sure, every community that can have its own state representative is supposed to have its own state representative.
Okay.
So let me think of an example. So right now we have a district that's Hudson and Pelham.
Okay.
Right, that's one district. Those two towns combined, I believe, get 11 reps. However, Pelham could have 3 of its own reps. Now, according to our state constitution, Pelham is supposed to be its own district. I don't know what happened the last redistricting process and why Pelham didn't get its own district. But in my interpretation of the state constitution, it should.
Okay.
But that's kind of an example, right? If you're a community and you can get your own state reps, then, you know, you're supposed to get your own state reps, right? Even if it's, whether it's one state rep or 10 state reps, if you're a community, you have a right to be, you know, the state's supposed to make you your own district with your own rep or reps.
Okay, so, and now the executive council, there are 5 on the council, correct?
Yeah.
Right. I have heard that some of the districts are drawn strangely. And again, that comes out of the redistricting process in
Correct.
In Congress.
Yeah, and what you're probably thinking about is District 2, which is Cindy Warmington's district. She's from Concord. But that district goes from, I'm trying to think. I don't think it includes Portsmouth, but I think it goes from Dover, Somersworth, Rochester to Concord, out west all the way down to Keene.
Wow.
It's a very, very skinny district. But
it is.
Sometimes, so here's the thing with gerrymandering. Sometimes constituents like when their district is gerrymandered, because if you gerrymander, you know, a few districts and you make it so then, you know, let's say, you know, an example might be with District 2, right? That district is a very, very liberal district. And there's a lot of small cities in that district that are liberal. A lot of the people that live in that district who are liberal and are saying, you know, if I'm from Keene or Concord or Somersworth or Dover, right, those communities are actually very similar. They're all small cities that exist in the state of New Hampshire. They may say, you know, I kind of like that I'm in a district with Keene rather than maybe some of the rural towns in this area, because, you know, Dover's interest and Concord's interest and Keene's interest might align a lot more than Dover's interest and, let's say, just for argument's sake, like Lee's interest, because Lee's right near Dover, right? Lee's actually somewhat of a liberal town too, but still, you see what I'm saying, right? The mm-hmm. demographic. So that's, you know, not to put a silver lining on it, but that can be the reality too, where constituents or leaders, local leaders in those cities and stuff say, actually, I kind of like that, you know, let's say you're, you know, there's all those cities actually, I believe, have Democratic mayors too. Actually, Keene has a Republican mayor, but for the most part, you know, typically those cities have Democratic mayors. So they might say, you know what, I like that there's someone from my own party representing this district, and that the other mayors who are also in this district also politically align with me, that we're all kind of an alliance and knowing, you know, what we want for the future of this state, right? And that could be also said for if we made a Republican executive council district the same way, where you could have a lot of rural select boards that say, you know, we're all very, you know, have the very same interests as rural select boards and what we want for our communities, and we all have similar party allegiance. And so having someone represent us in the executive council who has the ear of the governor, who shares those kinds of same those same interests and those same goals, they may find beneficial, right? So that is the tiny silver lining in gerrymandering. I still don't agree with gerrymandering. I think there's a lot of ethical questions. I think it makes it so then, you know, I think it's kind of a little erroneous for politicians to be drawing their own districts and to be drawing them in a way where they know that they're going to win the next election. I don't find that entirely fair. It makes it so that our elections are less competitive. But, you know, there are a lot of folks who do like the fact that I know I'm going to be represented by, you know, a person from my own party and local leaders that say I love the fact that, you know, the people who are also local leaders in this district are from my party and that the person representing all of us are from my party.
I think some of it may have to do with the fact that the average Joe Lunchpail really, I don't think he cares that much about how districts are drawn.
No, it's a very specific subset of voters, and I would actually argue that it's a very specific group of Democratic voters and people who might lean even a little bit more progressive that are very, very passionate about this issue and would like to see a nonpartisan redistricting committee. But, you know, I think that's constitutionally questionable because of the way our state constitution is written. It's very explicit that the general court, or that the state house, right, that our politicians do it. I think we're very transparent, though. New Hampshire's never had an issue with a gerrymandered district. You know, there's been things that are questionable, but nothing that's been egregious, right? Nothing that's been detrimental to the political system. And I think it's best for us to just have an open and transparent system the way we currently have it, right? Right now we have it where all the redistricting committee meetings are open to the public, mm-hmm. right? So they get to see everything that's... The public gets to see everything that's discussed. They get to watch those people draw those districts, and there's also public input, right? And I support the idea, and they do it voluntarily, the redistricting committee, but it's not required, but I think it should be required. And, you know, I know Representative Dan Wolf down in Newberry, I believe it is. He introduced a bill that would have required to have hearings in person at every county regarding redistricting in the process. And, I think that's actually a great idea. They already do that optionally, right? The redistricting committee will go county by county and have meetings about it. I think it should be required because I think, you know, it's good for people who can't drive all the way to Concord, whether they're from Coos or Carroll County or Cheshire County, that it's fair to, you know, go to them and say, okay, give us your, you know, here's your one day to give us some feedback. You know, give us some feedback on how you like, you know, the districts in your county and everything. So I think we do a very good job being transparent and open. Right. That doesn't necessarily it'll always be that way, but that's true with everything in life. You know, nothing's promised or guaranteed. But I think we have a great group of people, you know, led by I believe the chair is Barbara Griffin, who's chairing the redistricting committee, and she's a very fair, straight shooting lady. She's from Goffstown, Hillsborough's 6th district. But I think they're doing a great job. I think they're being transparent. And New Hampshire isn't like some of the other states that we've seen where politicians are very, very much looking to draw districts to keep their buddies in power in Washington, D.C., and to keep themselves in power within their state government. I mean, we also have so many state representatives, too. It's quite literally impossible, in my personal opinion, to gerrymander, you know, our ridiculous number of, you know, districts that we have in this state, right? And because of the way our state constitution's written again, too, and how every town's, you know, has a right to have its own state representative, it makes it impossible to, like, group towns together in weird configurations to get the best benefit, right?
Okay, yeah, I see that. It is 12:41, and we're talking with Brody Deshays, who's filling in for Jeb Bradley this Friday afternoon with sunshine and just a few clouds this afternoon. A beautiful day, by the way.
Yeah, really wonderful outside.
A little cooler for the weekend, maybe some showers as well. We'll keep an eye on that for you and keep you up to date throughout the weekend. But so we were talking about redistricting. How often does that happen?
10 years.
It's 10 years.
Every single census. Yep.
Okay, when the it's connected.
Yeah, when the census releases its data, and actually we're pretty slow on the process right now because the census data is just being released, you know, quite literally like over the past few weeks and the coming weeks, more data is going to be coming out too, I'm pretty sure. But happens every 10 years. We find out how many people exist in America who are citizens and live in every district. And then, you know, then we find out, you know, how do our districts now need to look so then every district has about the same amount of people and so it's all fair. So then every representative who's in Congress or every representative who's in your state house is representing about the same number of people in that, you know, your district is about the same size as every other district, right? It just makes it so then because if we never changed our districts, right, what would happen is what ended up happening. I don't know if you know this, but in Great Britain, they never changed some of their boroughs or districts that they had forever for Parliament when they first established Parliament after William of Orange took over, King William. And so you got to the point in like the Victorian age where like you'd have some aristocratic folks in Parliament who represented maybe like, because it was also tied to land owning for a while too, so it might have been a little bit before the Victorian age, but they were maybe representing like 5 to 6 other people who could actually vote for them. So, and it's because, I mean, originally when they established some of it, they established, you know, their districts for Parliament in a way where they're like, okay, this seems kind of fair today. And then 200 years later happened and, you know, obviously London had a way more people than, you know, other places, and other places were representing a tiny, tiny, minute number of people and getting, you know, one member of Parliament. And there were whole, you know, sections of London that, you know, were having to share a member of Parliament with another section of London. And that's kind of a prime example of why we go through this redistricting process to make sure that everything's balanced, that every single, you know, citizen in the United States and every single resident of New Hampshire, that the person that represents them represents the same number of people as the other representatives, and that that number, you know, is fairly equal, and that, you know, power is dispersed equally amongst, you know, all people, rural, suburban, and urban.
How long does this process take?
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, that's fair. Well, yeah, 10 years ago, you were a little young.
10 years ago, I was in... When they last went through this process, so they did the census in 2010, and they'll redistrict... It's 2021, so 2011. I was 12. I was 12 the last time we redistricted.
Like middle school?
Yeah. Yeah, I was a 7th grader, probably. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was in 7th grade, and redistricting was not on the forefront of my mind at the time.
I understand. Now, how exactly, I know you talked about the redistricting committee and all of that. When they get together, what is it that they need to do? I mean, we know that, you know, you said that they want to represent approximately the same number of people. So what they're looking at for the census data is where people have moved.
Yeah, so first, right, they look at the census data, and they look at, so first we have a formula for how many people each representative will represent. So first they crunch that number. Once they find out the state's population, they go, okay, each representative is going to represent about this many people. It was previously 3,400. I believe it's now 3,700 or 3,600, but it's gone up a little bit, and that always happens every 10 years. It goes up a little bit, right? So then they have to look at, okay, they have to look at, and they say, so let's look at counties. Are any counties losing seats? Because that makes it, if you lose a seat or gain a seat, right, looking at the counties, that makes it a little bit more difficult, right? And so you look at that.
Now just to make sure, this is a zero-sum game. If somebody loses one, somebody gains one.
Not necessarily. No, not necessarily. I mean, they New Hampshire only has 400 seats, right? And so there is the possibility where someone can lose one because, you know, maybe a community loses one because their community's population has decreased and the population needed to have a seat increases, right? But just because one area loses a seat, you know, I guess technically, yes, another area would gain a seat based on because our population has increased. But if New Hampshire's population decreased, then, I mean, it's a lot more complex than one wins and one loses. It's more just like, you know, do you have enough people to have a seat? Yes or no? And that's a question that you ask about 400 times.
Right.
Right. Or not 400 times, it's being a little hyperbolic, but there's 400 different seats, and there's probably about, I don't know, probably 200. There's got to be about 200 districts in the state. So you're looking at all 200 districts and ensuring that every district has enough people in it to have a seat, or just about. I mean, they can give or take, but they're trying to get as close to that, you know, that exact number of what is, I believe, 3,600 people or 3,700 people. So they look at every county and they say, have any counties lost or gained seats and everything? And then they look at, you know, every kind of town. They say, okay, what towns probably aren't going to get a seat? And they have to go county by county, right? And they have to look at the historical boundaries and the cultural boundaries too, right? Because a big thing that they like to do is keep districts within the same Senate district. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, you have to keep all the same districts within the same county, right? Because of the county delegation. So you can't have any districts that span across multiple counties. They have to all stay in the same county. They have to try to keep them culturally together, right? So, for example, they wouldn't put Wakefield with Wakefield, New Hampshire. They wouldn't put them with Tamworth because Tamworth, they don't have a similar school district. They don't tuition their kids to the same schools. They don't really, you know, there's nothing that ties those two communities together, right? So, however, on the other hand, Freedom and Tamworth, they both tuition to their students at Kennett. They, you know, they do a lot of like Little League stuff together, and they're both very similar towns in the same area of the county. So they try to keep those two towns together, right? So that's a prime example. Historically, Wolfboro, up until 2010 census, historically, Wolfboro is typically, depending on, you know, what year and how the populations work, is with Tuftonboro and Moultonboro.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the reason for that is because, and historically speaking, Moultonboro used to send its students to Kingswood Regional High School.
Right.
Now, I would almost argue that if that ever came to be the case where, you know, we had to draw that district again, it wouldn't make much sense for Moultonboro to be in Wolfboro's district because we're actually, you know, we're about 30 minutes from each other. And we don't have our kids going to the same schools. We don't share a lot of cultural things together. We do share a common interest in the lake and being fairly property wealthy towns. So that might be a reason why. But at the end of the day, we have a lot more in common with Tuftonboro. So it makes sense to put us together with Tuftonboro because Tuftonboro, they send their kids to Kingswood. Tuftonboro, some of their kids go to even our elementary schools, depending on how far away they live from Tuftonboro Central School. Tuftonboro uses a lot of some of our parks and rec programs. Tuftonboro, I mean, there's a whole number of reasons why we're pretty interconnected culturally and politically with Tuftonboro. So it would make sense for us to become a district. But quite literally, this is what they talk about, but with every county and every community across the state, the redistricting committee. And they have to make these decisions, and they have to talk to their local leaders, and they have to, you know, get input and say, so does it make sense still if we decide to put in, I'm just saying this hypothetically for everyone back home, Wolfboro, I'm pretty sure, will have its own district again, if not maybe adding Brookfield to it based on how the numbers look. But then again, these are the kinds of things that the redistricting committee discuss, though. When they need to put towns together, you know, is it appropriate to put towns together? Is there historical precedence? Does that historical precedence still make sense? How many districts does each county get? A big thing in Carroll County is we're kind of on the cusp of losing a seat, but we also were sort of on the cusp of losing there was a question of whether or not we should have gained a seat back in 2010, but we did. And part of the reason why, and it's a flatorial that's up north. There's a flatorial district. I believe it's District 7, where it represents, you know, the number of people that it's supposed to represent, because flatorials are a complex system all on their own. They're supposed to represent the excess people in districts, because if math can't work out perfectly, a flatorial that goes over the districts to say, okay, you know, here's the extra people that this person will represent. I think the reason why they kind of did it, though, to kind of, you know, tie a bow on it is so they could have an odd number, so there wouldn't be ties on the county delegation.
Okay.
Which is something also that I think that the redistricting committee has to consider is, are we going to create a seat that, you know, is there enough people to create the seat? And it's like, well, you know, these other districts in this rural area don't work out perfectly, so it's more fair to create that. And then the thing that might have pushed and I don't know why the previous redistricting committee made the decision, but I would, you know, conjecture that they said, well, you know, this is only going to represent this seat here. I think it was about 0.68 of a seat, or maybe it was 0.65 of a seat. And which sometimes isn't enough to get you a flatorial seat. But they were like, well, you know, a lot of these communities represent a little bit more than a seat. And so if you combine them all together, you know, it gets pretty close to a seat. But it also would be ideal for Carroll County to have an odd number on Vince County delegation to prevent any ties from happening.
Okay.
And so those are all the kinds of decisions that this redistricting, I know that was the longest answer I could have ever given to a simple question, but it's such a complex question. But they make all these decisions, and they essentially are the ones who, you know, this committee is the one that decides, you know, what's fair and why should districts look the way they are, and, you know, what's the best way of going about this and helping to allocate seats across the state of New Hampshire and within counties.
What, if any, input do reps and senators have into this process?
At any time, I mean, and at any time you can call any of the people on this redistricting committee. We have as much input as the public, but that's a lot of input.
Okay. So you can, as a private citizen.
As a private citizen or as a representative, you can call up anyone on this redistricting committee or send them an email. You can go to the state's website and to the general court's website and contact them and say, you know, I think, you know, Wolfboro should be with Brookfield for this reason. You know, let's say you're from Brookfield and you're listening to this and you say, you know, I'm right now in, you know, the Wakefield district, but Brookfield, you know, we might pay, you know, in Brookfield they pay for, I believe, Wakefield's emergency services, but they also send their kids to Wolfboro's elementary schools and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you might be a parent that lives in Brookfield and says, you know what, I think that the representatives in Wolfboro, that they're gonna, that the interest of Wolfboro's community and their representatives is gonna align more with Brookfield, and I think that we should be in this district. Or maybe you have the exact opposite opinion. You say, you know what, I love my representatives who are from Wakefield. I live in Brookfield, but, you know, I love my representatives in Wakefield, and I think, you know, Wakefield and their community's interests align more with Brookfield's community's interests, so I think we should stay in that district. And, you know, so that hypothetical Brookfield resident, you know, they should speak up and they should tell people, because, you know, communities like that can get bumped around to different districts and how the numbers work out. Or even if you live in Wolfboro and you say, you know what, I think we should be our own district. I don't want our representatives having to worry about another community's interest and, you know, our two communities' interests kind of conflicting at times. I think it's best for Wolfboro to be its own, to do its own, and to, for its representatives to represent only Wolfboro constituents and only their interests.
Do you agree with that, or is that just a hypothetical?
Just a hypothetical.
Okay.
No, I mean, I think I do prioritize Wolfboro more, and if another community was added to my district, you know, I'd have to prioritize their interests too. I would find it difficult to balance those interests if they came to a head, right? The majority of people would live in Wolfboro in such a district, no matter what district would be created. Right? A majority of people in this area of the county would live in Wolfboro in any kind of district. So you'd kind of have to look at it and say, okay, I have to go with, you know, what the majority of the people maybe in the district want. And at the same exact time, I have to use my judgment too, though, and say, well, is what the majority of the people want actually, you know, is that going to be good for all the communities in this district too? It does get more complex. And there are representatives who represent, for example, like Representative Bill Marsh, who represents Brookfield, Wakefield, Effingham, Ossipee, Sandwich, Tuftonboro, Moultonboro. Seven towns.
That's quite a bit.
And he has to balance all the needs of those seven towns.
Which are not always the same.
Which are obviously not always the same. And right. It can be difficult, right? And he's from Brookfield, which is the smallest town, right? So while he might feel some allegiance to Brookfield, right? I mean, there's every other town in the district's bigger than Brookfield. And typically, though, because it's all rural towns that are fairly conservative, their interests do align a lot more. But I've never asked him if the interest of one community in his district has conflicted with the interest of another and what he's done in that situation. But, I mean, that would be, I mean, senior lawmakers like Representative Marsh or other folks who across the state or even state senators, too, that have to do this on a daily basis. I would probably reach out to them and ask them and say, hey, how do you make the best decision for a district when you have so many towns, right? Well, and how do you use your judgment?
And that brings up an interesting question. You had mentioned the hypothetical adding to Wolfboro's district. So for argument's sake, let's just make the math easy. 4,000 people
you represent.
And 3,000 are in Wolfboro and 1,000 are in Effingham.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you look at the majority of the district, Wolfboro wins every time. That kind of, I hate to use this word, but it marginalizes the other people who may live in Effingham.
Well, that is a reality, and that's a big reason why people in all communities should speak up about redistricting, right? Because if you are in Brookfield right now and you feel as if, you know, you feel as if that your voice is being drowned out by larger communities in that district, then you should maybe speak up if you're a resident of Brookfield or, you know, of any town, whether it's Effingham, Tufton Borough, Freedom, Tamworth, Madison, Chatham, right? Chatham has only, like, what, 400 people?
Something like that.
But so you should speak up and you should say, hey, I feel as if my voice is being drowned out in this this district right now. I'd like to be in a district with towns that are more like mine, that are more small, and that, you know, we're going to have a little bit, the power is going to be balanced a little bit more, right? Mm-hmm. Putting Brookfield and Wolfboro in the same district, the power imbalance would be crazy. There's 6,400 people in Wolfboro and about 700 people in Brookfield.
Does the problem get worse as you go up ballot?
What do you mean?
As far as we talked about the majority, drawing districts and things like that, and different parts of the country may have different interests as opposed to different towns or different states.
I actually think it gets easier because when it gets that big and that extrapolated, right, the how you draw the districts and the cultural boundaries and et cetera, they start to become a little bit more vague. I mean, the state Supreme Courts tend to look at compactness of districts and, urban, suburban, and rural makeup of districts. And then historical boundaries, too. So it becomes a lot more... It's not like where, for example, there's no common culture in Congressional District 1 in this state. Right? There's not really a common culture as compared to, you know, Wolfboro and Brookfield. Right? Wolfboro and Brookfield are very different, you know... We're very similar. I don't want to say that we're like wicked different and that, you know, it could never work, but like they have a much different history and a way that their town government works compared to our town government. Their interests are a little bit different than our town's interests. Our town's a little bit more developed and more a little bit more business oriented. Theirs is a lot more of a bedroom community. So, but with Congressional District 1, you wouldn't necessarily have that issue, right? Or Congressional District 2. Like if you moved, you know, you move let's say hypothetically you move Wolfboro into Congressional District 2, it's not like it's that culturally weird for a suburban / rural town to be in Congressional District 2. Now, it'll never happen based on where we are geographically, but I'm just saying hypothetically, right? Like the kinds of things that they look at when drawing larger districts, it's a lot more numbers, right? They're looking more to even out the numbers, and they're looking a little bit more to be like, you know, how compact can we make these districts? And when they might look at like what kind of cultural things and regional things bring people together, maybe trying to keep the Lakes region together, keep the Manchester area together, keep the Seacoast together, and then keep the Monadnock region together in CD2, keep the North Country together in CD2, right? They try to look at those larger geographic interests where you have like 30 towns that all have the same geographic interest, and they all have a very loose geographic interest, but it's probably best. And then sometimes you can say, well, the math doesn't work out perfectly to keep the entire Lakes region. And I believe it's might be Center Harbor that's in CD2. It's like the only town in Belknap County that's in CD2, and they did that just because it's the way the math worked.
Right. Unfortunately, we are out of time, okay, though. coming up on Wednesday, All Things Politics.
Yep, All Things Politics with myself, Representative Brody Deshaies, 4 o'clock. I hope to see everyone there. And Eric, thank you for the opportunity again today.
Thank you for filling in for Senator Bradley. As always, you've done so very capably.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
1 o'clock, the news is next.